Portfolio Committee on Environmental Affairs. This is a follow-up meeting to the one that we held, I think, was it 2 weeks back or so, in the council, in the old assembly. So today we're expecting to receive a briefing from the minister regarding what has happened to the decision of the portfolio committee that was not followed by Sandparks. We received a letter from the minister on that day, and we resolved that we must respond to that letter. And as part of our response, we indicated that there was no miscommunication. The matter was straightforward. There were several meetings of the portfolio committee where a decision was taken, or several decisions were taken around the issue of agreement between Sandparks and the private, the owners of the private reserves there on the western boundary. There is a particular way in which the portfolio committee has determined that the matter must be handled. So our view was that there was no communication. So we requested that the minister must come and brief the committee. Unfortunately, we received an apology yesterday, which was also extended for today, that the minister will not be able to make it to the meeting because of a family emergency. So we have spoken to her yesterday. We have agreed that we will then do certain things, and in as far as her appearance to the committee will then reschedule as soon as she becomes available. We will reschedule. We are left with about 2 weeks. So it will either be next week or week after next, where we hope that she will come back to us and then deal with the matters that we asked that she must deal with, and then find finality on this particular issue. So we are not going to receive a presentation from her today for those reasons. We will then postpone her appearance to either next week or week after next, or any time that is convenient for her to come to the committee. For now, we will then take Sandparks to then deal with the issues that were outstanding from last week, from 2 weeks back, about the proposed agreement. It evolved from being a concept. Now we are at the point where we talk about a draft agreement. So we are going to take presentation about what are the key features of that draft agreement that has been proposed, and then take it from there. We also thought that we need to have a discussion, as originally agreed in September last year, to discuss the hunting protocols and the processes in determining the offtakes and the role of the parties, community benefits, and what are the control measures to deal with non-compliance. So that will be in the proposed agreement. So it's possible that if we secure the minister's availability for next week, we will then have to ask that SANParks should come back next week or week after next. Or if needs be, we might have to ask that we must go to Pretoria as a committee to meet with the minister there if she can't come this side. So that's how important is this matter for us before we rise, so that we leave this matter sorted out and closed properly. And then after that, we'll receive a briefing on the third quarterly report from SANParks. And then, of course, we're going to get preparations from briefing on the preparations for CITES by the department. So we are going to have a bit of a long day today. We've received a couple of apologies. The deputy minister is attending cabinet committees. Cabinet Committee on Economic Sectors, Employment and Infrastructure Development. And the DDG is attending a preparatory meeting for the presidential event, Goods Green Deeds launch that is taking place in East London. I think which was what the president announced during the reply to the State of the Nation. So the DG would not be around. And there's also apology for next week. The DG will be attending UNEA, taking place in Nairobi, Kenya. And then Honorable Mkuni will be coming a bit late. Khadewe is sick. Nyambi is attending another committee meeting, I guess. And the rest of the other members they've deserted their posts. Pardon? Missing in action. Yeah. No, they've deserted their post there. Okay. Any other thing before we start with the presentations? Okay, so what we'll do now, we'll just get a briefing from SANParks. As I said, we would have loved to have this presentation be made after we've received the briefing from the minister. But seeing that the minister is not around, we'll proceed with the briefing. But of course, the discussion may be subject to that engagement with the minister, the finalization of the matter itself. So I'm going to hand over to the chair of the board to then introduce and present somebody who's going to take us through the presentation.
Morning, honorable chair, honorable, I don't know if this microphone is working. Thank you. Sorry. Morning, honorable chair, honorable members. Thank you very much for the opportunity. We have prepared a presentation that follows as closely as possible the outline provided by the Portfolio Committee. I think it is a presentation that provides considerable detail on all of the issues, specifically on the issues around the agreement, the framework agreement itself, the process that was followed, who the signatories are, what is in the agreement, as well as then going into quite a lot of detail on the issue of the approach to community beneficiation, and more than community beneficiation, the issue of rural development and the opportunities in the area, as well as looking at the hunting issue and compliance and enforcement. I think that when it comes to the issues of compliance, just to say that SANParks, like any other institution in the area, is subject to national and provincial legislation, and I think it might be necessary that the department also comes in at that point in the presentation. The CEO will introduce the team and take us through the presentation, and then should there be questions of detail, there are a number of the SANParks team would then be in a position to answer in relation to the areas that they are responsible for. So thank you very much. Just one more thing to say, that I think given the length of the presentation and the detail, there might be issues that the CEO would not necessarily go into in detail, but certainly when it comes to questions, we could pursue any matters that haven't been spoken to. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Morning, Chair, honorable members. For this part of the presentation, I'm with the head of Kruger National Park, Glenn Phillips, and then my other colleagues are for the part of the APP Quota 3, the COO, the outside, Lisa McCourt, the CFO, Tumisani Lamini, and also the head of strategic management, Jill Bandingfender. As the chair of the board indicated, we are following the brief that was given to us. Chair, because of the nature of the project, what we did, we rearranged slides to flow nicely. Let me apologize that you are seeing a new printout, but it's the same text. We haven't changed text, but what we did is to rearrange the slides. We're going to start at number one by talking to the cooperative agreements on the roles of parties as per brief. Following that will be the focus on community benefits. We have added also another beneficiation scheme, which is not part of this, is a complete separate regime altogether, which is was part of the settlement of the land claims in the Kruger National Park. Moving from that, as the chair of the board indicated, the compliance issues will be led by the department because they are embedded in the legislation. And also we talk about the hunting protocol at the end of the presentation. This is the process we propose to follow, honorable members. I think we are familiar with the mandate of SANParks. I won't go to that. And also our vision and mission. Just to indicate that, as you can see, the mission is about a whole range of issues that we need to do when we manage this system of national parks. I must also indicate, if you look at the CBD, Convention on Biological Diversity, most of the conservation approach of South Africa is following those three legs of the CBD. One is the actual conservation of biodiversity, the ease of sustainable use and its components, and also fair and equitable sharing of benefits arising from the conservation of the natural resources. In Sandparks, we have those goals, conservation, tourism, and socio-economic development. In doing that, we need to look at issues of financial sustainability. We look at accountable corporate governance and also optimize our business processes and systems. As I outlined, we will follow that process in terms of our presentation. In terms of part one, we thought that let us share with the committee the evolution of conservation globally. In the early 90s, it was about the three P's, where you were protecting, preserving, and propagating. That was the ideology at that time. It evolved in the, it was early 1960s, mid-60s up in 1990s. It was about now measuring, monitoring, and manipulation. I think the global movement on conservation matters evolved further, where there was more about the three I's of integrating, innovation, and internationalization of conservation issues. That's why there are so many UN structures looking at the broad range of conservation matters. The new era, of course, is about people benefiting from the natural resources. Just Kuganaspal in context, I'm talking here about the western boundary. Again, we talk of 2 million people on the western boundary of Kruger, which is about 350 kilometers fence line, which is also managed by, as a veterinary fence by agriculture. It straddles two provinces, three district municipalities, nine local municipalities, two biosphere reserves, the Blyde and Vembe, seven community forums that we're working with, and 39 traditional authorities. It is part of Great Limpopo Transfrontier Conservation Area. The treaty was signed in 2002, we'll show in the next slide. Therefore, it has Kruger National Park in context in the western boundary. In the north, it's bordered by Zimbabwe, in the east by Mozambique. Hence, there's a treaty in place. What triggered this cooperative agreement? There was a slow implementation of the treaty. A treaty that was signed in 2002. I think governance issues were not being accelerated. Therefore, on this, we're not alone. Zimbabwe and Mozambique are on board in terms of the Greater Limpopo Transfrontier Park. There were scale of challenges. I also had opportunities around the area. And then there was a fragmented, poorly regulated open conservation system, hence the agreement. There were varied agreements, honorable members. At times, there were no agreements for the sound conservation in the area. There were changes in regulatory frameworks, of course, poor governance in many areas. We can make many examples around this. There was a fragmented approach on issues of socio-economic development and benefit sharing. Poor land use planning because to fragmentation, especially in the buffer zone. Hence, the attempt was to look at issues of land use compatibility. Because if you do that, you avoid what you call a human-wildlife conflict, which normally happens around most of the national parks and nature reserves. There was an issue of increasing security threats due to issues of poaching or wildlife crime. I want to highlight, honorable members, Section 9.2 of the agreement stipulates clearly that the revised agreement, for all its intents and purpose, supersedes all previous agreements. Because besides the APNR agreement, there's more agreements that were in place. I'll show now in the next slide. The process started, of course, in beginning 2015. to look at a couple of issues in terms of best practice, enabling operational environment, resilient communities, unlocking socio-economic development, leveraging on joint opportunities, and also harmonize and prioritize integrated land uses in terms of clustering moving forward. I'm just showing in this slide the timelines that were followed. You can see there is an element of overlap here because the western bound is very busy. The land claims were settled. There was a provision that look at a beneficiation scheme for land claimants. That was one. Whilst we're doing that, we also started to regularize the relationship on the western boundary. You can see the stakeholders were involved in that process. At the same time, the management plan of Kruger was due for review. Therefore, you can see that period, a range of issues did happen, and then there were lots of consultations in doing the plan. I remember we went as far as consulting people sitting in Cape Town on this paper. They were interested to say, what type of plan are you doing? There were 54 stakeholder workshops, 5,762 participants, and 483 written comments submitted in that process. Of course, the plan was finalized, the management plan, which was approved by Minister in November 2018. But in that plan, I need to mention that the same cooperative agreement is part of that plan, that it should be in place. But moving forward, we need now to talk, to do certain things in terms of putting into action what has been agreed, monitoring, and make sure there are outcomes. This slide is showing the phases. There was a phase of treaty, which is 6 million hectares, Mozambique and South Africa and Zimbabwe. There was a phase of regularizing at the western boundary. If you look from the north, honorable members, you can see their agreements. Handling starts from the top, from Makuya. There's handling there, there's handling in Makuleke, there's handling in the Taba Ranch, all the way. APNR is that cluster there. You can see there's a new, it starts all the way there. That was the phase of regularizing. Phase two is to expand and consolidate, and then phase three is to integrate the whole sector. This slide is showing signatories that signed the agreement. I note your comment, Honorable Chair, but I'm just being upfront here. Makuleke, Makuya, Andalidet, Letaba, Andalidet, Kijana, Conservation is a new, this is the traditional authority that is part of that. The APNR group is that group that we bolded there. They are sitting around in that cluster there. And then we have Manyeleti under MTP in Mpumalanga, Malamala, Sub-Descent, Mchechane in the south, and also these are all starting from the north all the way down the neighboring partners, and new ones and old ones. But there are still some ones who come on board who have not yet agreed on this. There are rules that are highlighted in the agreement for each party. There must be a joint management committee in order to make sure that the governance structures work. All communications and interventions must be transparent in the relationship. They should be fair. They should be supported. They should be true, proper governance structures. There must be some responsibility when you deal with ecological issues, socio-economic issues, animal health issues, because there are a problem in that red zone. The issue of security, are very, very important, but we want to see outcomes. And then parties must comply with the current protocols, the management plans and agreements, and also, of course, joint SOPs, protocols, guidelines will be required. They will have to be improved in doing that. Just in summary, these are the key elements of the agreement. There's an element of governance. There's an element on conservation management. There's an element of socio-economic beneficiation. There's an element of safety and security. There's an element on land inclusion. That's the crux of the whole agreement. We clustered those things in those areas. I will request Glenn, all the members and chair, to talk to the focus on community benefits. In doing so, she will also talk to the main claimants one, which is a separate regime altogether. Glenn.
Sorry, can you expand on the key elements? Because this is what we are interested in understanding and knowing. When you talk of land inclusion, what exactly does it mean? Safety and security, what does it mean? Can you please unpack this? Okay. I don't know whether is there a slide that will talk to this as we proceed.
The detail of the agreement, Chair.
Yeah.
No, Chairperson, we just clustered like this. Otherwise, it was going to be very long. But we can, because I think in the back of the honorable members, there should be a copy of the plan, of which we can zoom into those issues here, with your permission.
Yeah, please do that.
Okay. Chair, at a high level, we will zoom there. Under governance, I think it has been clear over years that there was an element of non-compliance with certain things, especially with legislation and management plans. Therefore, this must be enhanced to make sure that people comply. There were issues of declaring of additional land to add to the protected area estate. That one needs to be looked at, because some of the people say, I want to be a nature reserve. You realize that it's not declared a nature reserve. Therefore, people do as they wish, but they want the status of being associated with conservation. But they are not complying with the conservation rules. Under conservation management, there are many issues happening even outside the boundary. Water use, development of furrow irrigation, which is taking water from the main system, the issue of animal population management, the issues of farm management, which also comes from outside the park, not from within the park. Under socio-economic beneficiation, there was no cognizance of the regional economic development, which is part of the treaty, for that matter, because there's a program called Boundless Southern Africa. There are DFCA programs that is in place. Therefore, it gets ignored. There are issues of responsible tourism. You cannot willingly develop as you wish, because there are also water issues that are coming to play and also impact on environment. Enterprise development was ignored, and also the issue of community access and social investment. Under safety and security, both sides, by the way, of the park, both east and the west, you need to buffer some elements of criminality. You need most of the landowners to have plans to secure the boundary, because criminals move from the villages. They go through these protected areas. Sometimes of these areas are a loophole for us because there are no plans. Therefore, we try to make sure that there must be radio communication, there must be ops rooms, there must be also other ways of reporting and some of the intelligence-driven operations. Under land inclusion is about the issue of integrating, because we showed last time one slide where we were saying, although Kruger is a park, but there are many important ecological pieces of land which are sitting outside the park that must be integrated. On that note, Chair, I'll ask Glenn to talk directly to some of the, zoom into what is in the agreement, Chairperson.
Thank you, Chair, honourable members. If I go to the document that was sent out, can you hear me?
Sorry? Can you hear me?
Honourable members, Chair, thank you for the opportunity. If you go to the document that was sent, it dated November 2018, on page 10, it says 3.2 key elements of the agreement. It breaks down a little bit further what those key elements are and what underpins those key elements. It has submission on the front page at the top right-hand side. So that's essentially, from a governance perspective, the key issues there is regularization in terms of the required regulations under NEMPA, as well as the alignment to SPLUMA. That's specifically around governance issues. Are you finding it? Sorry, Chair. It's at 3.2. This document looks like this. Got it. Okay. So the governance are the areas. It's alignment to the required governance. A lot of these land parcels are still under agricultural land, for example, and are not aligned to protected area status, even though they are in some cases being managed by certain authorities. So they have to be regularized. Under environmental management, also under NEMBA, in terms of the management plans, resource use plans, compliance with environmental authorization processes, cooperation on issues such as catchment level water resource management, and the management of species such as elephants in the landscape. Currently, it's everybody is managing elephants in a different way, and yet it's an open system. So one of the processes we're currently busy with is the planning of a landscape level elephant management plan. So it deals with not only on the South African side, but all the way onto the Mozambique side as well. That process is currently underway. The CE has touched on socioeconomic benefits. Currently, a lot of small things are happening around the park, and we'll touch on that under the community benefits a bit further. But there's nothing is being coordinated, and there's nothing that we can measure ourselves against, specifically around issues such as the minimum standards of responsible tourism, which should be measured and met, particularly as Sandparks, as a government department. We should be setting the example, along with the people that are operating in the open system. The other one was around safety and security. The CE has touched on that, and the formulation, of course, in that open system is also working with a whole lot of different partners, state-owned institutions, such as the SANDF, the SAPS, and its structures, as well as other private security structures that are operating in the various parks, anti-poaching units, and the like. There has been a forum that's been set up called GCAP, Greater Kruger Environmental Protection Forum, where all the wardens of the various units sit from the western boundary to discuss law enforcement challenges and how we coordinate around those aspects. And then, of course, the land inclusion really revolves around the implementation of the GLTFCA treaty, and where land makes sense to include as protected areas, or land that is on the boundary that lends itself to an integrated opportunity, such as vegetables, for example, where we have the demand of all the lodges, is how do we help stimulate agricultural work in the area and provide the demand for those suppliers. So there's a myriad of aspects. That's high level, Chair.
Also, I hope it's there, with the copy of the actual agreement. On page 9, it talks about the pillars of the agreement. You can see from 6.1, governance is there, but it is explained more than the summarized version. Therefore, if honorable members can look at that. It talks about the detail on each of those, from 6.1 all the way to 6.5, and then it goes about monitoring and evaluation moving forward. I'm not sure, Chairperson, if you want us to go through more of those. We seek your guidance here.
I think let's proceed and conclude the presentation. The question that was asked in the past is that what are the key features of the agreement? What are the responsibilities of each party to the agreement? These private owners bring land in return for what? What are the key stakeholders bringing into the party, so to speak? And I'm not getting that coming up. I think it was still at the realm of the abstract. We are still somewhere there. We haven't zoomed into the details of what exactly is this thing all about.
Chair, maybe I can try and respond. I mean, we in a situation in that area where the land is most appropriate for conservation. I think that is one of the issues that we're sitting with, and there is considerable benefit to the state in terms of the issues relating to biodiversity and conservation, and for the landowners, the economic opportunities that accrue from keeping their land under conservation use rather than turning it into agriculture or any other kind of land use. So I think the one thing that binds everybody in that area together is really the potential economic opportunity from conservation as a predominant land use. I think the second thing is the ecological benefits for sand parks, and for the landowners from the fact that the fences have been taken down, and that allows a much greater area in which animals can roam, and that obviously then improves the conservation element of the land, again, for the private landowners and for government. I think the third thing that is the big benefit of that, and it's not only for the western boundary, but it's also for the eastern boundary, so in the context of Zimbabwe and Mozambique, is the fact that the greater this area under conservation, the bigger the opportunities are in order to be able to market it as a premier conservation and tourism destination internationally, and then on the basis of working together to be able to accrue the benefits that would arise from that, so that you can then compete, for example, with Okavango in Botswana or Serengeti in Tanzania, that you've got a huge marketable tourism destination internationally that attracts a lot of people both domestically and internationally. I think from the sandparks perspective, our concern has always been that you have this huge population of 2 million people on the western boundary who have effectively been shut out from being able to benefit from that situation, apart from being employed as workers both in sandparks and the reserves. And this agreement brings them in as stakeholders with a real benefit. So I think in summary, that's what the benefit for us is.
No, I'm talking about... What is it that each party is going to do in terms of this agreement?
Okay.
Yeah. Not the benefits, not the rationale of entering into this, not all of that we know. are there any specifics that we can zoom into?
Chair, if I can come in. Mm. Chair, so essentially what the agreement is providing for us is a framework for us to negotiate going forward on all the SOPs,
all the standards, all the compliance
issues.
What is the SOP? Standard operating procedures for everybody and how they operate. So what this agreement does, it firstly defines the principles under which we're going to move forward. It highlights the key elements, which are those five that we need to address going forward as in a joint manner. And going forward now, based on that and meeting all those regulatory requirements, everybody has to start performing according to the requirements of the Act, which we'll get onto a bit later in terms of the NEMPA and NEMBA, and their management plans must comply. Out of that, annually, they will be audited, as we are, under a MET assessment, to see if they're meeting those objectives. That is covered a bit further on in the presentation in terms of what everybody has to do and what has to be improved going forward.
Chair, there are also clear objectives and principles in the agreement. For example, parties to the agreement, they agree that there will be issues. I'm just lifting the things, but they are on page 7, para 4. Issues of procurement opportunities are there. Community involvement and partnerships are there. If you go over, there are issues of community support. There are issues of responsible tourism opportunities or consumptive and non-consumptive use of natural resources. All I'm saying is that if one reads this, by agreeing to this, there has to be transactions between the parties to deliver on this. This is why there's a provision for monitoring and evaluation chairperson of those things, because agreement is an agreement. Implementation is different, but it's a start of cooperation to say we agreed to do these things together, because in the past chapter it was absent completely. By agreeing on this, we'll be looking at procurement, we'll be looking at community participation, we'll be looking at beneficiation schemes, even the issues of shareholding. Therefore, for agreeing to this, further transactions will follow between parties, between communities, because if you look at the boundary, even the cluster of landowners themselves, they differ on certain things. You can take the APNR, if I'm correct, Len. There are some who are not doing hunting. There are some who do hunting. There are some emphasizing on tourism. But they'll have chairperson to cooperate in terms of governance issues. But for now, they seem to run their own different things. They have their own separate constitutions they want to abide by. Even in the negotiations, when we met with them, they brought their lawyers to say, I cannot change my constitution, because my constitution says only as 12 of us, we must be in this cluster. We're saying, no, new entrants must come on board to be part of this bigger initiative.
I think... I don't know whether we're not understanding each other or what's happening, but let's proceed to the presentation. I don't get to have a sense of whether you understand the question so that you can zoom into the details, but I think let's proceed. Maybe we'll get the responses as we move along, or we'll have an opportunity at the end to ask questions.
Thank you, Chair, but Chair will be willing to unpack further. We will continue for now, Chairperson, as you propose. I would like to ask, Chairperson, with your permission, Glenn, to do the part two of the presentation around the focus on community benefits. Glenn?
Thank you, Chair. If I go on to the next one. So essentially, what was the purpose of the agreement in terms of beneficiation? Firstly, it was to address participation of local communities and traditional authorities in the whole Greater Kruger. Currently, it was predominantly private landowners that were operating in the area and very few community operators, and yet there is land with this potential. It had to address the risks associated with cooperation with different legal statuses, different business models and management approaches to try and align them. Also to facilitate cooperation and collaboration in common issues of common interest. And one of those key issues, of course, is socioeconomic development, which is highlighted in the agreement, in numerous chapters of the agreement. And, of course, as we said, capitalizing collective opportunities such as joint destination marketing as an example. If you look at the little map on the left, there are so many different aspects in terms of livestock and crop farming. There's the whole biospheres that the CE mentioned, different settlements on the agreement, issues around catchment and water challenges leading into towards the park and through communities. And there's, of course, the big sugarcane estates on the Crocodile River in the south, also drawing of a lot of water and, of course, a lot of chemicals going into the Crocodile River. There's also issue of mining in these different areas, and of course the cross-border aspects that need to be managed from a trade perspective. One of the big challenges we face in the region, of course, is unemployment. You can see the different regions around the Kruger National Park that we engage with, and the unemployment rate, as you see, ranges from around 30% in Bombela all the way to over 50% in certain areas. And as you go further north in the park, it seems to get worse in certain areas as well as you go down to a micro level. So there's a whole lot of different ways in which people can benefit from having a conservation area next to you. For some reason, the middle is not showing on the slide, but essentially the benefits to society are varied. There's the well-being element, material, physical, social, spirituality, security, and freedom of choice. But there's also the aspects around employment, business opportunities, of course, capacity building, infrastructure support, direct benefits from the ecosystem, managing relationships, and restoring rights. And there's a whole lot of programs on the left and right that you can see in the presentation that attempts to deal with these, and these are all contained in the management plan in terms of us delivering on these issues so that we can address some of the requirements that came out in the park management plan process. We also fully understand that the issue around land restitution has received increasing focus over the past 3 years of the process, and that has been taken into account in this process. At the end, and lastly, the bottom two little ovals, as I said, it's not the presentation is not showing correctly. It needs to discuss what our mandate is, and, of course, what the conservation constituency, which involves everybody else that's part of conservation in the area, and what they have to deliver on. SANParks can't deliver on this alone. It means that there has to be a collective approach to deliver on these benefits. So the discussion was, how do we address this? And what we decided was we have to break this down into a cluster approach because of the scale. But one of the key guiding criteria in addressing this is the socioeconomic youth, women, and education awareness and how we address these issues in the clusters, but also ensuring there's an enabling institutional framework and good governance, because that is one of the big challenges we face in regularizing this whole Western boundary aspect. So what we've also done further is to look at a macro scale, what does each area lend itself to in terms of opportunity? And all the way around the park, from north to south, there are various opportunities that could come into play in the region, and the various partners that also play a role in each of these clusters, NGOs, other government partners that will have to play their role. But and these are all aligned to the development plans of each region and each municipality as part of the process. We then go down to the next scale, which is and you can't see it in the presentation, but we then go down to specific projects that are incorporated once again into the management plan that hold opportunity that we can start linking to and ensuring that we deliver on
again, in a collaborative approach. And this is where the big socioeconomic development opportunities come from in the region. The long-term objective is, of course, to grow the total socioeconomic impact and the GDP of the region. So we've recently, through a PhD research, Alex Chikadel has done an assessment of the socioeconomic impact and the multiplier effects in the region. And if you look on the right, you will see the economy of Kruger, which is 2 million hectares, as you know, brings in terms of, with a multiplier effect, about 1.7 billion into the national GDP. If you look at the smaller reserves, bringing in about 360,000 hectares, the multiplier effects are 2,318 into the GDP. So even though they're smaller areas in terms of the reserves, they have a bigger impact from a socioeconomic development perspective. The issue is, how do we work together to enhance this even further? Part of this process is to develop a tool that on an annual basis we can actually report back to say, this is the baseline we have, and every year this is how we've grown the GDP because of our collective action moving forward. The second aspect is around the land claims that the CE mentioned as well. Currently, you will know there are 16 land claimant communities in the park. On the right-hand side, Matt shows the land parcels that are claimed. And part of the restitution process is that SANParks plays a role in this beneficiation scheme. And there are various elements in the beneficiation scheme ranking from equity to participation in specific projects such as Kukuza Safari Lodge, educational aspects, and there's a whole variety that operates around here, around the scheme. The scheme is not finalized yet. It is due to be finalized shortly. But this is a parallel process to ensure that we deliver on the requirements of the Cabinet decision of 2008. This is just the next slide just details the process of where we are at the moment. Currently, they are busy with the stakeholder and community processes, item 7, with the final agreement taking place this year. There are some current challenges that I must bring to the attention of the committee, where certain groupings are unhappy with the Cabinet decision of 2008, and there may be some challenges around that coming our way, but we are trying to manage that along with the Land Claims Commissioner.
What is the Cabinet decision?
Basically that there will not be a restitution of the land and that there will be a beneficiation scheme in perpetuity. And there's challenges on that issue, but see, do you want to elaborate a bit more?
If I may expand, Chair. There were two cabinet decisions around a settlement of land claims against created areas. There was one of 2008 that was saying, as a claimant, you can get a title, but the land use won't change. Therefore, you get your land, as you get the title, but the land will remain a conservation area. That was one. The one for Kruger was specifically for Kruger. Because of its role, the cabinet says, under those options of settlement, Kruger will be financial compensation chairperson. Therefore, claimants will be given money. But on top of that, in that agreement, it says SANParks must develop a beneficiation scheme to be signed by the claimant community and SANParks. If you look at the previous, go to the previous slide. Previous slide.
Sorry.
Yes. On this slide, this is where we developed the proposals. We went to the board. For example, percentage is cost of Safari Lodge, then free equity on new concessions, a percentage of game sales, and preferential jobs for the communities, procurement opportunities for the communities. All that was packaged is being negotiated with the land claimants. This is the agreement we need to reach with them now, but we're at that stage, Chairperson.
Add on that, when the land claims are in the land claim process, when a land claim is settled, the Land Claims Commission has to make a determination about whether restoration of the land is feasible or whether another form of settlement and another form of compensation should be paid. So in the actual process that went to the Land Claims Commission, this land was determined to not be feasible for physical restoration, but then there was this agreement that the communities need to benefit. Maybe important to say is that the SANParks investment in the communities and the long-term partnership around beneficiation between SANParks and the community is on top of a financial settlement that was reached between the Land Claims Commission and the communities. So there is it's around a 300 million rand settlement agreement. 300 million rand has been paid to those communities in compensation already, and then in order for them to have a long-term stake in a conservation process, this beneficiation agreement is intended to give them, not in addition to that 300 million rand bulk settlement that was agreed and that was paid by government, this is intended to try and give them in perpetuity an income stream and a stream of benefits and a stream of jobs and a stream of skills for the young people in those communities that would last for generations into the future.
With the permission, are we done then? I will hand over now to the DDG to do the compliance part as it embedded in the legislation. But I want to start there, can I just?
Yeah. Chief, I'll just start on the first slide if I can. And it comes down to the chair's, one of the chair's earlier questions as to the roles and responsibilities and what everybody has to comply with. Firstly, as was mentioned, compliance oversight is done through the Executive Joint Management Committee, which basically is representative of all the signatories to the agreement, and they have they sit in that committee to ensure implementation according to those clusters that we spoke about. All signatories have to comply with the Protected Areas Act, all environmental legal frameworks, norms and standards and regulations. Some do not at the moment, and that is part of the regularization process. They have to have a NEMPA-approved management plan and all that goes with that. Management authorities, of course, are assigned either by the minister or the provincial MEC. And it's at that level that enforcement to compliance is required. So in some cases, it would not be SANParks enforcing compliance because we will also be measured on the same basis as per the legislation. Entities that are not compliant may lose their land use status, or a different management authority may be assigned, as legislation allows, or in some cases we may have to fence out entities. In other words, they will become islands in that landscape in some cases. That's not ideal from a conservation perspective, but it may be a last resort if we have mavericks that are not willing to work together with the larger grouping. The agreement provides, of course, for the development of a range of protocols and guidelines. One of such, which is also in the pack, is the development of the hunting protocol, the Greater Kruger Hunting Protocol, which is also under process and has been for some time, which would also need to be adhered to by anybody that hunts in that open system. And then, of course, as I mentioned earlier, there are the management effectiveness tracking tool assessments that are done and audited independently. There was a baseline done of all of these areas, so we know where we all stand at the moment, and they will have to be, and then every time that assessment is done, gaps are identified and they must correct those gaps, as we do as well. And, of course, annual reports must be submitted on all the key elements of the cooperative agreement, so we can measure performance as well. I'm going to hand over then to the DDG.
Thank you very much. Honourable Chair and Honourable Members, I just want to expand on the aspects of compliance especially with regards to NEMPA, which is the Protected Areas Act, and also in specifically the norms and standards associated with those that have declared or designated their areas as private nature reserves. I've requested Carl Naidu, who works with this on a daily basis, just to talk through some of the provisions that will apply in line of compliance, as Glenn has indicated earlier. Kali?
Thank you, Chair, honorable members. The next three slides will talk specifically around compliance. First two slides will refer...
Maybe just do the introduction first.
Sorry, Chair. My name is Kali Nudia. I work for the Department of Environmental Affairs with a specific focus on NEMPA, and specifically that's a Protected Areas Act, specifically around declarations, monitoring, and compliance. So that's where the responsibility sits around that. Thanks, Chair.
What's your designation?
Director.
Okay.
Director, Protected Area Planning, Legislation, Compliance,
you must
Monitoring.
Tell us your designation. Most people, majority actually, are working for DEA, so we know you work for DEA. Yeah, okay, proceed.
Thank you, Chair. I'll start off by the first section within NEMPA, Section 40, that sits under the management criteria. And this section specifically says that the management authority must manage the area exclusively for the purpose for which it's declared. Now remember, when a protected area is declared, it does have a specific purpose. And it must be done in accordance with the management plan of the area. And I think the management plan has been mentioned a number of times as the base for this management and on how what you do with a protected area. Also in accordance with the Act. This is NEMPA, the Biodiversity Act, the NEMA, National Environmental Management Act, and other applicable national legislation, any applicable provincial legislation in the case of provincial protected areas, and then also any applicable municipal bylaws in the case where it's a local protected area. And the local protected areas, that falls under the local municipalities. Now, Section 41, that talks about management plan, indicates that a management plan for these protected areas must contain at least, and we've highlighted three areas, such planning measures, controls, and performance criteria as may be prescribed, a program for the implementation of the plan and its costing, and then very important, a zoning of the area indicating what activities may take place in different sections of the area and the conservation objectives of those specific sections. This is a fairly critical part of the management plan that gives you the base of what you can do where, under what conditions. The second or the next part talks about monitoring and supervision, and it refers to performance indicators, Section 43. There's two sections under Section 43 of NEMPA, but we've clumped them together. One talks about the minister, and the second one talks about the MEC, and the language are the same, so we've just put them together. The Minister or MEC may establish indicators for monitoring performance with regard to the management of the national protected areas, provincial protected areas, and local protected areas, and the conservation of the biodiversity in those areas. Now, the management authority of a protected area must monitor the area against the indicators set in terms of Section 1 and 2, annually report its findings to the Minister or MEC, as the case may be, or a person designated by the Minister or MEC. And then, on top of that, the Minister or MEC may appoint external auditors to monitor the management authority's compliance with the overall objectives. So it's not only an internal, but it can be an external auditing as well. Second one, Section 44 of the Act, also under monitoring and supervision, and it was mentioned before in the presentation that this section talks about termination of the mandate to manage a protected area. Now remember, a protected area once declared gets a management authority designated, Now, this section talks about if the management authority of a protected area is not performing its duties in terms of the management plan for the area, or is underperforming with regard to the management of the area of the biodiversity, the minister or the MAC, as the case may be, must, first of all, notify the management authority in writing of the failure, and then secondly, direct the management authority to take corrective steps to sort out the issues identified. Now, if the management authority fails to take the required steps, the minister or the MSC may terminate the management authority's mandate to manage this protected area and could assign another organ of state as the management authority to this area. Now, this section specifically refers to if you are doing your work or not and what steps can be taken to rectify that if you are underperforming or not doing what you're supposed to be doing. The third slide talks to the norms and standards for private nature reserves. Now, norms and standards were... Sorry, Chair?
I'm going to ask that we jump this part.
All right.
It's very important, but for now, we want to zoom into the agreement and the hunting protocols and stuff. We don't have enough time. Okay, can we go to the hunting protocols?
Thank you, Chair. Essentially, from it's important that we give background in terms of hunting in the context of conservation. And there is, I'll move the slide. We recognise that that it can be seen as a controversial issue, both internationally and locally, specifically because of certain hunting practices that give a bad name to the practice. So we recognise that. Nevertheless, properly regulated sustainable hunting is considered to be a legitimate practice and plays an important role in the financial viability, expansion of biodiversity conservation land uses, particularly in non-state-owned protected areas. And I think key in South Africa is, to a large degree, the areas under conservation, around half are owned by the private sector, and of course they need to be able to fund that, and a lot of that is done through hunting processes. The demands for competing land use are not compatible with conservation practices highlights the need for viable conservation incentives and alternatives, of course. So well-governed hunting generates critically needed incentives and revenue to maintain and restore wildlife as a land use and carry out conservation actions, including anti-poaching interventions, which we are currently besetted with. But it has to be properly managed, it has to be measured, and if that is done, it can provide much-needed income, jobs and the like. From a South African legislation perspective, I think it's all very clear. The committee is fully aware of the legislation around hunting, and so we've just included that slide in for reference. From a sandbox perspective, the policy framework does not allow for hunting in our national parks, although the legal framework does provide for it in NEMPA. We are committed to supporting ethical, sustainable and resilient wildlife economy initiatives, particularly in conservation areas adjacent to national parks, and specifically in areas that are marginal, particularly in the north of the area of the park, which are not part of the main tourist routes. There has to be guiding principles to govern such approaches. And the protocol which we have distributed in the pack is a draft protocol that has been under negotiation. One of the first data in the pack that was distributed to everybody, I'm not sure where exactly it is. The title, it looks like this. It looks like the front page of this document.
Yeah. Can't see that pack,
yeah? Yes.
It's so bundled together.
Thank you. It is a draft. It's in the process of negotiation. That process is, with the backing of the cooperative agreement, setting the principles on how we operate,
this can now formally go through a process of negotiation with those that practice hunting in those open areas. So it's recognized from a SANPARK perspective that diverse...
So there's currently no protocol?
There's no formal protocol other than what is regulated through the MTPA and LADET. There's no protocol governing the open system to the manner that's required. It's more about the hunting principles of how they operate under the authorities that manage hunting, which is not SANPARK.
Which is what?
Hunting is regulated. The responsibility for managing hunting is devolved to the provincial authorities, to Mpumalanga and to Limpopo, and they are the authorities that authorize hunting, receive hunting applications, are meant to certify hunting outfitters. So that legislative responsibility sits with the provinces at the moment. There's no hunting in national parks. We have no control over what the provincial authorities do, and it is a provincial function at the moment.
So currently there's no hunting protocol.
Not between SANPARK and all these open areas. There's no protocol in place right now because there was never a negotiated process at all, merely using what MTPA and LADET were using.
But we would want to see a protocol, and I think that part of this agreement is an attempt to say that this situation is an untenable situation, and if we are going to be in an open system, then a critical deliverable of the agreement is that everybody who is part of that agreement must sign on to a common protocol, a common set of principles, and a common approach in relation to hunting, in addition legislation.
Don't give a long answer. We don't really have enough time. Just want to check whether no protocol, yes, no. And then we move on. So currently, it's regulated by Mpumalanga, and so there's no role for SANPARKS.
Chair, there is a role in terms of, because of the open system, of us having input into what they're requesting to hunt from a scientific and a conservation perspective. And on the next slide, I go through that process.
Okay.
So the protocol, basically just these are the principles under which the proposed protocol is being written and developed. I don't think I need to go all through that, pretty clear as to what we're trying to achieve there. The next slide looks at the process. So essentially there are specific steps in the process, Chair, and firstly the management plans of those protected areas or nature reserves must provide for hunting in their management plans. They must, as step two, they must provide ecological surveys, censuses, special studies, observations to inform the offtakes. And that's normally done around August, October every year. They then submit detailed post-offtake records from the previous year's hunt, also around October, to be taken into account. The offtake committees make recommendations to the respective exco structures. These are the structures that are in the areas that hunt. This is not a SANPARK structure. It's their governance structures. And the next step is that EXCO structure then obtains support from KNP, LADET, and MTPA based on the following supporting documentation. The offtake information, the management plans, the signed protocols that they have, the members being part of the constitution, of that parcel of land, motivation of financial sustainability and service level agreements. So that we then give input to say, if you look at the right-hand block on the top there, we comment on what is being recommended by or requested, and we give our input from a conservation and science perspective. The provincial authorities then do the due diligence, and they issue permits, they regulate and regularize if there are challenges in those areas. So essentially we give comment from a conservation and scientific point of view. And then of course going forward is the feedback loop that is required. If I go to the next slide, I think this is what's important, is what needs to be improved. So procedure, and this is what we're trying to address in the protocol. Procedurally, the following governance aspects must improve. Conduct joint censuses. Currently, a census is done by the different protected areas or nature reserves and sand parks independently. We want joint censuses so we get a count that is far more accurate, because things specifically in smaller conservation areas, the situation can change quite rapidly. Necessary internal and external communication and dispute protocols must be in place. The EXCO members of those various parties must endorse the hunting offtakes in writing. All approved quotas must be publicly known. And currently, if we are requested by any of the media to provide anything that we have commented on, we provide that information, particularly once it's been approved by MTPA and the DET. We're not seen to be hiding any information. We also feel there should be external review and auditing of these offtakes, so it's not seen as an internal process. The management plans of parties must ensure that the resource use practices, governance and zonation plans deal with hunting in that area, and they must be understood by all the landowners. And all parties should be informed before a hunt, so that we're not having anti-poaching reactions because there was miscommunication or no communication. Second is the open transparency and transparent communication between all parties. And lastly, but probably most importantly, we as the entire area must demonstrate the contribution of this to environmental, socioeconomic outcomes. And I think that's a very important thing going forward, so we can actually prove whether it's a viable practice or not in that area. That's me, Chair.
Chair, next slide, please. Chair, I think the vision is to protect the product estate, Chairperson, and also we have obligations to contribute to product socio-economic environment, and we need to cooperate. Therefore, this agreement, Chair, we see as an innovative, transparent structural process that need to enhance the treaty. And Chair, I must say today, we saw this thing long time ago, that regularization need to happen, there's fragmentation, even the issues of quota offtakes. Provinces, they have a legislative process to do that. We send parks, we can just participate. Therefore, Chairperson, all of this, even in the provision, under Section 4 of the agreement, this offtake is embedded there that there must be protocol in place. Therefore, Chair, moving forward, we still need to continue to engage on the actual implementation between stakeholders, between provinces, in order to see the clear outcomes of this framework. Thank you, Chair. We'll leave it there.
Okay. Thank you very much. So, hunting has been taking place without any hunting protocol in the Greater Kruger National Park. Is that the case? This is the first draft.
Chair, it's been happening according to the current laws of the management authorities of those parcels of land. That's what has been under those specific laws. There's no joint protocol in place to be all on the same page, and they are different, as you heard in the previous aspect, where the NCOP had not yet implemented the issue around baiting, for example. Things were not aligned, and this is what we're trying to do here.
Okay, because I'm trying to understand that there was a dropping of the fences. When were they dropped?
96 and then various different times after that.
96.
So the fences were dropped in 96 to allow the animals to move freely, knowing that they are going to be hunted on the other side, on the private reserve. And there was nothing put in place to safeguard the hunting of those animals. Because the putting down of the fences greatly benefits the private reserves. And so there was nothing that Kruger National Park could do or Sand Parks could do to protect those animals from being hunted on the other side.
I think, Chair, that when we all came into Sand Parks in 2015, we identified it as a problem at that point in time, which is why we took the opportunity of the need to review the management plan in order to start the process of negotiating an agreement that would ensure that we manage that situation. So, yes, the reality is that from 1996 up until 2015, we operated solely, the situation operated solely under national and provincial legislation. But we identified it as a gap, which is why there has been work done over the last few years in order to sign a protocol and to get a situation in place that is much more helpful to everybody, because animals roam both ways. And you're right that we need to have amongst everybody who has animals within that open system, and especially as that open system becomes larger and larger, we do need to have an agreement. So, yes, that's
so what
why
was
we
the
started.
Previous agreement saying about hunting, the 96 agreement?
Chair, it was a very open agreement, the ones that had agreements.
What was it saying?
It was basically saying that the principles of sustainable use are accepted, so that was how it was being managed. And also there were certain things that should have happened in terms of moving forward to ensure the controls were put in place or processes were put in place, standard operating procedures. Those never happened over time. So that's what we're trying to correct now, is that was never in place. So there was a basic agreement. If we talk purely about the APNR, and the same with Sabi Sands. Sabi Sands fences were dropped. Yes, they all had animals when they were dropped. Sabi Sands have to do off-takes. It may not be hunting, but they've got to take off animals now and again because they've got too many. And sometimes they sell them to hunters, or they have to cull them. So there are various management aspects that are implemented in terms of managing the environment. But hunting is one element where it was seen as a revenue generation opportunity, not so much as a management intervention always. So that's what needs to be controlled now in a far more structured approach.
Okay. It's quite shocking because we all thought that there's some agreement on how these animals are going to be hunted, the hunting protocol that was kept on being referred to. Okay, I'm going to open for members to ask questions, but I must say that I think the entirety of the presentation missed what we really wanted to get, at least on the hunting protocols. I think they and the offtakes, there at least they have been given a picture, including the draft. I like the draft because it's quite detailed. This the draft agreement or the draft Greater Kruger Hunting Protocol is quite detailed about what can and what cannot be done. But on the other agreement itself, the cooperation agreement, I think we are still poorer in terms of understanding exactly what does it provide for, except all the high-level things that we have been told. Honorable members, I see you've been taking notes. I don't know whether you want to ask questions or you are you are happy with the presentation. Honourable Pettit.
Yeah. Okay, Chair, I've learnt a lot this morning. I've got a few questions and comments, but whoever is the relevant person to answer them, if they wouldn't mind just taking the notes. I think one must, certainly I can see the challenges involved, yeah, and I recognize all the work that's gone into this. It doesn't help that you've got three district municipalities and nine local municipalities, and sadly most of those are dysfunctional with high unemployment, so there's huge pressure on the park, yeah. But I want to know, were these municipalities and these various forums and authorities did they attend the park management consultations that were referred to in the stakeholder workshops? I think that's important. The communities, were they part of it? It's a big area, over 2 million people living there, so this is a massive challenge. Coming to the protocol and the transformation, Transfrontier Conservation Agreement, I just want clarity that this supersedes the previous agreements. But coming out of it, I think for me a major plus is the enforcement of compliance that will go with this. But the question I have for the JMC, the Joint Management Committee, which will make the decisions going forward, I think we need to know who will sit on that. I mean, it can't be that all signatories will sit on that. That's just unwieldy. So I just think, is it going to be elected? Does it involve the provincial governments? I think we need to know that. Now, the way I understood it, and this is where I want clarity, because I would have presumed that before taking fences down in the 1996, and I presume they were MOUs, because agreement, something had to be signed before taking fences down, is that an audit of animals would have to take place. So you're not coming into the process of bringing a barren piece of land. And I assumed, is that how the biomass was calculated in relation to the park next door, and that's how the hunting allocations were formulated? That's I think I just need some clarity on that, because we told there was no hunting protocol before, so you know, we need to know on what basis hunting or no hunting. And of course some of those signatories or some of these areas would have come down would have come in with no animals, and some with lots of animals. So it's important that we know that some of the people, you know, I just would have thought there would have been an audit. So maybe we can get clarity on that. Because the important thing here for is the biomass, the quantity of animals in the given area, and all the challenges that go with it, you know, the culling, the... but another... area where I need clarity is the role of the provinces, because Joanne, you said that it was revolved around the provinces, but the way I understand it is that the provinces are only there for the applications for exporting of trophies, not for internal hunting. If you want to go and have a shoot for your deep freeze, I don't think the province would be approached for you to fill your deep freeze. So the hunting protocol, I think, is a very important document. And the hunting decisions in this protocol are very clear. And I think there's an enormous amount of work gone into it. So I think going forward,
The other question I had is the protocol effective dates. I'm not sure on that. Is it a coming into effect, and how long will it last for? Is it a 3-year thing? Is it a 1-year thing? I think we need to know the time, the timing of that. I think, Chair, this this whole process needs cool heads. Yeah. Not everyone's going to agree with this thing, and not everyone's going to disagree. But I do think we should recognize there's an enormous amount of work gone in here to meet substantial challenges, huge challenges. And anyone who visits the area physically will understand those challenges. There's also a possibility, and that if a member or one of these signatories, if they're not allowed to hunt, there is a possibility that they could put their own fences up. And then landing the Kruger Park an extra burden of security we know it's not great for conservation because the bigger the area, the better. But there's a fact, someone mentioned islands, but there's a fact that if it doesn't go, there's nothing stopping them putting their own fences up. So I think we need to look at it at all angles. We need to proceed with cool heads here. I think it's a major step forward. There are going to be serious opposition to some of it. And as I said, agreement most, but I think we are much closer, moving in the right direction, and I look forward to further comments.
Okay, thank you. Any more question, comment? All right, responses?
Thank you, Chairperson. I will kickstart response to Honourable Patton, but Glenn will add the details. The big question was, were municipalities consulted?
The municipalities
consulted, yes. The answer will be yes, but how do they react to it in terms of moving forward? This is one of the reasons, Chairperson and all members, I've been dying your back. There are two letters I wrote to the DG and the late minister to enhance exactly that, to say, can we do roadshows for implementation? The one to the minister was to for her to consult premiers and MEC. The DG one was to consult the HODs. They are in the process of doing that. Minister, they later even responded to say, let's look at her diary. Was because of that, Honourable Patton, to say, I know municipalities are busy, but will they come on board next week's implementation? I'm hoping that will still happen, that roadshow, to showcase this work. That's one. Glenn will add more on that. And the JMC, Glenn will respond. But to be candid, Honourable Members, the 1996 agreement is very, very difficult for the current management and the current board to respond to that. Because we have the same questions. That what was the stock before dropping the fences? How many animals? Were they moving in which direction? Were they sensors? Was there a record? Therefore, it's haunting us. I also want to stay on members here. When I was at DDG, this question came up. What we did, we developed a buffer zone. The buffer zone was also soft, not talking to the core issue. Hence, coming to Sandparks with the new board, we prioritized this. From early 2015, let's look at this thing because there's something wrong here. Therefore, it's difficult to answer that one, but we can try and dig the archives, but we couldn't find anything that says what was the stock, why were the censors were done. But I think something went wrong big time there. On the role of provinces, perhaps GGG can assist us because of the semi-federal system in terms of conservation in our country. The issue about hunting for your fridge, because it's their land, they are contributing to conservation. Perhaps we might want to unpack the incentives for them, because if they can't do that, it might be a disincentive to invest in protecting the animals and do all of that. Therefore, I think it's one area we can look at and come back to the committee. The risk of them putting their own fences and disinvesting is very high at the same time. That's why this balancing act is very, very important. Glenn, may you add on the details on the duration, the protocol, you can add on the JMC appointment. Thank you.
Thank you. If I can just go back to firstly in terms of municipalities, Honourable Burton, they were consulted. Some did attend, some did not attend the actual park management plan consultant processes. However, we have engaged at each municipality in terms of the IDPs and the SDFs. So they are in terms of how we've zoned the park, we've tried to zone it as much as we can according to what's happening outside the park as well. So that has taken place. But as the CE says, we need further engagement in terms of clear roles and responsibilities for the implementation. The new agreement it certainly supersedes all other agreements. That was the intention, is that we didn't want to have a whole lot of different agreements with different protocols and principles. We wanted to make it easier for us to manage based on the principles of the treaty as well as legislation. In terms of the joint management committees, it is currently the chairperson of each of the signatories, as well as the head ranger or warden of each of those areas that's on the JMC. Yes, it will be unwieldy at the beginning because there are 14 the moment that we need to address and in the future more, but we need it's going to be a process to whittle it down in the future, but we need everybody on board at the beginning so we can establish it in a far more consultative process and we're all on the same page. So that will take a bit of time to address. However, in terms of the operational, there's also a joint operations committee which each cluster has, and they will do the hard work in terms of delivering and ensuring regularization on all those five topics and dealing with it, and they will feed into the JMC. So the JMC was really more about dealing with the strategic aspects than the day-to-day operational issues. And the provincial agencies in terms of LADET and MTP are also party to the JMC as well. What I understand in terms of the land that was incorporated is those were going concerns and game reserves in their own right at those times. The fences were dropped from ecological perspective in terms of movement of animals. And that was the basis of it at that point. And yes, like we learned in lots of the other park, contractual park agreements, which we're reviewing across the country at the moment, those things need to be more standardized, and hence this process around that. In terms of the protocol, at the moment the discussion is it's 3 years, so we can learn in the process, but it can be reviewed or upgraded along the process as we learn moving forward. But currently the discussion is 3 years. Was there anything else, CE?
Honourable Chair, on the question, but they touched on it on the role of provinces in this regard. I think it's also important to note the current dynamics, especially of the areas that were reflected here. Your Manyeleti, Endova, Lidaba, Makuya, most of these areas are owned by communities as land claimed and restituted but remained in that arrangement that CE spoke about, where they remain as conservation areas, but wholly, if in bracket, in bracketed text, owned, but provinces being management authorities for those areas. So in terms of the offtakes, there is communication between these management authorities, as in Limpopo, and also as in MTPA, with the landowners in that regard as per the restitution. And in that case, you would find that the process that Glenn spoke about, where the sensors, the management plans, the scientific interface between them and KNP, the permitting that comes in terms of the offtake and the processes that are followed, then the management authorities will manage that part. So it's not only the management authorities alone, but we also need to factor in the owners of the land itself in terms of their expectations in the process and their push for certain, or expectations on certain benefits that are associated with that. That's the dynamic on that. I'm not referring to the former APNR as it used to be, but also the other areas that are coming, including what C was indicating earlier on, that there are more areas that are being brought on board to be considered for incorporation as well. So the proposed hunting protocol and the other agreements that may follow as part of this framework hopefully will assist in regularizing how the relationship is supposed to be across the board, maybe in a more equitable and fair manner for everyone, irrespective of the different dynamics that are involved. Thank you.
Honourable Perez, follow-up.
Thank you. Just to clarity purposes, the JMC chair of signatories, the head warden of each area, provinces to be representative, and have you included yourselves, Kruger, as one of the chairs of the signatories, or over and above this? What representation has Kruger or Sandparks got on these JMC?
I'm currently the chair, the initial chair of the JMC, along with the General Manager of Conservation Services and the General Manager of Scientific Services, as well as the Chief Ranger. So we are represented on that.
It's a new structure. It's a structure that has always been existing.
It's a new structure in terms of trying to get everybody to start implementation of key issues that are urgent, particularly around safety and security, for example, that are currently challenges.
So the previous offtakes, how did they work? And
so previous offtakes, from a Sandparks perspective, we of course also do offtakes now and again, so that is done through our own internal processes and the protocols and SOPs we have.
No, the issuing of licenses in the reserves where hunting is allowed.
That was done by the provinces through the process which I detailed earlier, those steps. They would issue all permits and regulate.
And what was the role of Sandparks?
Sandparks purely gave comment from an ecological and scientific perspective.
Just comments?
Yeah, correct.
What was also missing there, the census? There was no joint census because you need to count together. But what was happening, provinces will count and say, we know there are so many animals in our side. It could be the weather of the day. There can be so many. But what you are pushing for is a joint census. We count it together before we come to an offtake figure. But before it was done separately, Chairperson.
Okay. All right. I think I was trying to get some information. Somebody sent me some information about the history of the private reserves there and the Kruger, and when the fence were dropped and what was happening there. It has got pictures of people who attended that event, and the former minister during the apartheid years who was there to declare. I think the first fences were dropped if my memory serves me correctly, with the what has been, what is now called, is it Mala Mala, that was restituted with I don't know how many billions of rands. That was the first one where the fences were dropped, according to the information that I was sent. I was trying to get out of it. I don't think it started in 1996, because 1996 was after we attained our democracy. And it would have been by the democratic government. But what I saw is not it was by the previous regime, with the what do they call them, the homelands. There was somebody from Kangwane there who was representing the community in terms of the information that I got. So I just don't have it now. But I wanted us to zoom on the agreement. What was the previous one saying? What was the new one going to say? Because clearly there is a benefit here of the private reserved owners. And I needed to understand how are they benefiting from this thing. Because now it looks like it's just a free license. Honorable Peden asked the fundamental question. What happened before the fences were dropped? What happened? Was there some kind of a census conducted? Was it established how many animals are this site, how many animals are this site? Which is quite clear that that was not done. How the fences were dropped, who was benefiting out of that? Because quite clearly it's not Kruger National Park. Of course, you expand the area of protection, but in any case, those were already the protected areas. Those were the nature reserves. So they are already protected. It's not like you are acquiring land which is not protected at all. So the argument about expanding the footprint of protection does not hold water, because those are the private nature reserves. That land is under protection. So we needed to understand exactly what is the reason which we are not getting. What was the agreement saying that was signed? Because agreement provides for what are the parties supposed to, what is this party supposed to bring into the table? What is the other party supposed to bring into the table? So that question remains unanswered. Why were the fences dropped? And what were the benefits for all the parties? And even on the new agreement, as I said, we are still in the abstract, you know, in the high level. We have not been taken through what are the details of the agreements, what is the role of each party. What is quite clear is that there is a benefit from the animals coming from Kruger, which are being hunted. And from 96, let's assume that 96 was the first time the fences were dropped, up to 2019. I don't know how many years is that. We have not been having fences. Fences have been dropped. We have not been having a hunting protocol, because one of the key benefits is the fact that the animals are coming this side, and those animals are being hunted where hunting is allowed, and no hunting protocol that exists. Basically a blank check that was given. I've looked at the draft one, and I think I agree with Honorable Peden. A lot of work has gone into that, and a lot of ideas, which is something that should have happened long time ago. So I think in as far as this one is concerned, the sooner it gets implemented, the better. I haven't looked at all of it. What does it say? Of course, it must also be subject to some level of consultation, get inputs before we finalize it. But it's a good step, you know, to say what is it that we can hunt, where hunting is allowed, what is it that you cannot hunt, and how must you go about conducting that hunting, which is something that has not been there. But I'm still not satisfied about what does the agreement say, the cooperation agreement says. The problem is that we get given a lot of slides which quite honestly are really not necessary for our purpose of wanting to find out what the draft agreement says. I still call it a draft now because we still have to get some feedback from the minister about the issues that we raised, how was it concluded, despite what we have said at the end of the day. Honourable Pedden, you saw your hand.
Yeah, thanks, Chair. there's a lot of detail in these documents, but I think we must understand that animals are migratory as well, so this is not an easy exercise when you sitting down and working out offtakes, because it's what happens, and the times of drought and certain aspects. So that JMC has got a extremely difficult, hard job going forward. But the no one mentioned the impact of tourism. Has that been taken into account, Chair?
Okay. Which is, I think, one of the other benefits of the private, because you might find that they didn't have the lions and the elephants. Now all of a sudden the elephants are coming from Kruger, coming to the private reserves. So somebody doesn't have to go to Kruger to access to see the animals. You can just visit the private reserve and you are in Kruger already. So, yeah, so that's the other benefit. Yeah, but answer the question.
Chair, I think on your first point, we have to agree with you 100%, because it's highly possible that 96 was only the signing of the vague one. They have started long time ago. We can only agree with you, Chairperson, because we will be interested in your information we have, sure, but we'll research more because I never saw those pictures. But it's highly possible, sure, we are right that it might have happened, because that's 1996 was just fixing. But that fixing was very vague. It was, if you read that agreement, I think it's 6 pages. I've looked at it, we once brought it here also, sure. It's so vague. It doesn't say much, Chairperson. Chairperson, the points are taken. We are also take to bond your concerns that there was no hunting protocol. Yes, it's true, Chairperson. And then we take the point that we must speed up the protocol to be in place so that we can have some form of a control.
Thank you, Chair. I'm going to comment on the question from Honourable Purden. In terms of tourism, yes, that has been taken into account in terms of firstly how we measure tourism and the impact of tourism, and hence the development of the Responsible Tourism Toolkit, which we will all subscribe to, and Fair Trade Tourism through a tender process was appointed to develop those minimum standards aligned to the national minimum standards for us to all adopt as a measurement tool for the implementation of those standards. And those issues, of course, will deal with energy efficiency, water use, footprint on the landscape. All those aspects are taken into account.
Okay.
I think we've come to the end of our engagement. As I said, it should have been preceded by the engagement with the minister, which we will still have to engage. You are not off the hook yet. Yes, sir. Yeah, you defied us. There must be consequences for that defiance. So we will still engage. We'll call you back. But on the issue of the hunting protocol, I think there we are very clear that you must move forward and make sure that that is put in place so that you can regulate that, because just to give inputs, but somebody else will take the decision. So it's better if there are hunting protocols, which also the provincial departments will also be guided by those kind of protocols. Okay, let's step off this one and get the quarterly report, the third quarter, I think. Can we do it in 15 minutes? Unfortunately, we had to deal with a lot of information which was really unnecessary for the purpose of which we wanted to engage. But I know the more the slides which are confusing, the better for you coming here. But we don't get easily confused by all of these things. Can we get... Are you going to be able to do it in, say, 15 minutes?
Right. Chairperson, it's possible. Chair, may I suggest perhaps I will request the head of strategy to do it. Perhaps, Chair, in the interest of time, we do only the yellows and the reds.
Yeah.
Where we haven't delivered for quarter three. Chair, the yellows and the reds. Chairperson, the CFO will talk quickly to one pager on the quarterly performance on finances. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair and members, honourable members and Chair. As the CEO indicated, I'm just going to go through the ones that are red and yellow. So on page 10 in your pack, you will see that when we speak about the percentage reduction of water consumption, we're actually not 100% completed there in terms of the audits that had to be done in Golden Cade Islands and Marikeli National Park, as there are no bulk water meters installed for baseline determination, as well as in Okhravis and Mapungubwe. We're currently looking at the cost estimates to install those relevant machinery, but we can report on a 27% reduction in Agulhas National Park and a 95% reduction in Bontebok National Park, with a slight increase in Wilderness National Park of 3%. If we go to the next performance indicator, we are talking about the water reduction, percentage water reduction in Kruger National Park. There's actually been a 2.59% increase in water consumption, and this is due to the very high temperatures and low rainfall during October and November. This led to increased water consumption at the larger camps and also at staff villages. On the next page, we are looking at total hectares of land rehabilitated. If we look at the initial hectares, we are only at 77% of the target we set for quarter three, which is 21,908 hectares. Rehabilitation of that is below 23%, below target by 23%. You must have all heard or read about the fires in the Garden Route, which destroyed most of the planned areas for alien invasive vegetation clearing. There's also a reduction of Working for Water and Ecosystems budget to make provision for VAT, and this might also impact on the achievement on the annual target. So in terms of the follow-up target, we're not that far behind. We're in the yellow, but there was a late start in the Kruger National Park projects due to new selection processes of contractors and Table Mountain National Park's management problems with the various contractors and project management capacity in the Garden Route. When we go to the next slide, page 12, we're still on total hectares of land rehabilitated. We are quite far behind when it comes to wetlands. We've only rehabilitated 2,905 cubic meters. Unfortunately, this program started very late, 4 months later than planned, due to delays in finalization of our MOU between Sandfox and DIA. The redesign of structures in Marakele will also impact on the cubic meters target for the year. Then on to the next performance indicator, which is the total number of park management plans reviewed and submitted per annum. We are not quite there for the quarter. The draft management plan for Mapungubwe National Park was completed and is now ready to go out for stakeholder participation. And then the draft management plan for the Garden Route National Park is behind schedule due to the fires in the area, which I've just mentioned. There is a disaster recovery plan in place to catch up with everything that needs to be done. So those are all green. We go to page 16, and we're talking about percentage implementation of the annual elephant plan. We have done 6 out of the 9 scheduled activities, so we are at 67%. And outstanding of those activities are in KNP, the intervention protocol to disturb elephants at a local scale must still be finalized. Mapungubwe National Park, there's a report tracking elephant incursions into exclosures aimed at protecting riverine forest and culturally sensitive sites. That is not completed as yet. And then in Edo Elephant National Park, the number of elephant bulls moved from Temba to Edo Main Camp is still in process. If we go to page 18, we're looking at a yellow. Percentage implementation of the Sandbox Wildlife Utilization Strategic Plan. We're at 81.3% delivery of those quarterly targets. The planned capture and delivery of animals donated to 2 local communities around Marakele National Park was delayed due to concerns for the well-being of the animals given the high temperatures and the start of the lambing calving season. And the second reason is delivery of all outstanding animals for both loans and donations will resume in March 2019 with the opening of the game capture season. Next page, page 19, we are looking at the implementation of our cultural heritage management plan. We have only completed 7 of the 10 activities planned, and what is still outstanding is the international facilitators which have just come on board, the MOU delayed by the Ditsong officials, and then funding proposal for Tulamela. If we go to page 22, we are looking at our tourism, enhanced tourism returns. We are looking at the total number of visitors to national parks. We have actually decreased by 3.9% year on year. This is due to VAT increases and subsequent increases on commodities such as fuel. The differential conservation fees that were implemented in the Table Mountain National Park in November, and we just wish to indicate that we have looked at ourselves against domestic tourism overall. So domestic tourism, as reported by Stats SA, declined by 11.9% totally during this quarter that we are talking about. If we go to page 23, we're looking at total number of accommodation unit nights sold. So we have only sold 435,735,000 unit nights sold. The national average year declined by 2.3%. That's the one reason, and then the other, the number of units that have been decommissioned for maintenance and or refurbishments had also had an impact on that. So if we go to page 25, we are talking about total number of revenue-generating products implemented. We had planned to implement 4 this quarter, but we've only implemented 2, and that was the Boulders Retail Facility and then the Golden Gate Classics. The Letaba and Palaboro Lodge concession is on hold due to land claimants' inquiries, which has now been resolved, and the tender will be adapted accordingly. If we go to page 26, we talk about rand value spent on SMMEs through the EPWP programs. So we've spent 1.46 million on the SMMEs. This target was missed due to the II and Richtersveld project not commencing. Then we go to the integrated transformation strategy developed. The target was that the procurement process be completed to appoint a service provider to start looking at the status quo, also where Sanpox currently are with transformation. So all of those have been completed, and in fact we are appointing someone on this coming Friday. Then we go to page 29, which is the number of social legacy projects implemented. Unfortunately, all projects are still in the planning and procurement phase in quarter 3. Then when we come to page 32, we're talking about our employment equity and in terms of the total male to female ratio, which is set at 1 to 0.7, and we've reached 1 to 0.6. Then in terms of our skills training, 6% of payroll spent on skills development program, not 6%, it's 3%. We've spent 0.69%, and you can see the total there of what we have spent, because the bulk of the payment is due at the end of quarter 4 or at the end of the year. Then we go to the last one, which is page 38, and this is the total revenue generated from fundraising per annum. We did raise just over 17 million, but it is still under our target of 12.6 per quarter, so it would have been about 45 million that we had to get together by now. And that's it, Chair, from my side. Just the last one, just to indicate that we have achieved 72% of our targets. We are 12% almost there, those ones that are still in progress, and there's a red flag around 15% of our performance indicators.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah,
let's get, give us all the slides we have on finances.
All right, okay. Thank you very much, Honorable Chair. In front of you, I've got the highlight, financial highlights of the organization at the group level. You will note, Chair, that our revenue is actually behind our target by 35 million. And in mainly, it's the economic factors and some of the issues which have been highlighted under performance, fuel costs, the issues of VAT, which have actually resulted in having lower visitors numbers into our park than what we would have anticipated. You'll see that all of these impact on the main revenue lines, including your tourism income, your retail gross profit, which are significantly down because of those numbers. You will also note that in terms of special projects,
the income that has been recognized is far below what you've anticipated by this time. And again, it's driven by a number of capital projects, because we recognize revenue in those income when we complete those projects. And projects of capital nature usually take time to complete. In terms of total expenditure, you will see that our total expenditure is also 11% behind target, which translates to about 181 million. Now, leading in that particular area, you have maintenance costs, which are far behind target, which is about 72 million. And the reason for that is because of lack of capacity of people who have to maintain the asset that we have. And the second part of it is because of delayed procurement. I mean, SCM is quite a challenge in public sector. It's followed by the second largest variance that we have under expenditure, which is people cost. You'll see that we are 40 million behind our expenditure in people cost. And again, it's bulk of it is vacancies. Vacancies that have not been filled, and you'll see the ripple effect. If you don't have people, then you can't spend on your operating expenditure, because you need people to drive those expenditure. In terms of operating costs, we're also behind our budget, 34 million savings, which is currently shown, and mainly of it is the data as well as voice services, as well as IT outsource services, including savings on operating lease. Those are the main highlights, Chair, and I'm happy to take questions. Thank you.
Okay, is that it? Didn't we say the last time that give us more detail? Was it you?
Chair, you indicated that when I talk to a slide, I must talk to what I have. If I need to talk more, then I must expand on it. So I must expand on the presentation and give.
I remember your first engagement with us, you gave us this one page and we said, please give us more detail. Expand. Didn't we say so?
Maybe I could not recall correctly, Chair, but thank you for reminding me.
Yes, we came with our annual, you did check, but
yeah, you did check.
It was doing our annual, full annual thing, that there were missing things that you did check.
Okay. So you keep on forgetting. Okay. Please don't do that. You see, on financial reporting here, and many people, I think it's an area that they don't take seriously. I, for one, I would like to see details about the financial expenditure, income expenditure, the income statement, and so forth, so that we can understand quite comprehensively the financial position of the organization. I'm saying this for the second time, and unfortunately we are doing this at the point when we are exiting the system. But please, in future, when you come to the committee CFO, do that. Excuse me. Any questions from the members? Honourable Pettit.
Thanks, Chair. I'll start with the finance maintenance costs. You said lack of capacity. I'm struggling to understand that. And also, maybe you can tell us to what extent you employ from outside, you know, SMMEs, for example, outside the parks to come in. I'm using Kruger as an example. Well, any of the parks for that matter. Because SMMEs was mentioned with the II and Lichtersfeld, a lot of money there. But if you could just tell us what those projects were that they didn't commence, II and Lichtersfeld. I think your number of visitors down can't be blamed just on VAT and fuel. I think it's just the economy in general, I think. But the positive trend of Rhino fatalities is encouraging, although it's still unacceptably high, but at least there's a positive trend down, which is a major challenge, not just for the Kruger, but for the country. And there's much hard work gone into that, and I don't think that the rangers and the people involved get the credit that they deserve. So I'd like to give them the credit that they deserve. They work extremely hard under very difficult circumstances. And then the increase in water consumption, maybe someone can tell us the new lodge, has it got, I'm hoping it's got recycling facilities maybe, because that's going to use a lot more water in Skukuza. So maybe someone can tell us about that. Thanks.
Okay. You mentioned that the SCM process takes long because there's a problem of SCM in the public sector. And then about this maintenance, that there are no people. Can you expand on that? Are you saying that we must accept because of the fact that in the public sector there will always be delay in SCM? Is that what the message we are getting? Okay.
Chair, on the oral pardon question on maintenance, Glenn will chip in on Kruger because there's an element of a backlog in Kruger, but CFO will start with that. And also, we noted the Rhino trends, honorable member, and the credit, thank you very much. On the water consumption of the lodge, Glenn will also add. We'll also address the honorable chair's comments also on the same issues. Thank you. Okay, CFO.
Thank you for the questions. Let me start with the issue of maintenance. Glenn is going to deal with them in detail in terms of what's happening in technical services, in particular in Kruger. We have a team of people who actually assist us to do maintenance in all our properties and establishment, from fixing an aircon to doing basic maintenance to make sure that all establishments are up to standard. Now, we're experiencing a high vacancy rate in that particular area because the industry is just poaching engineers, quantity surveyors, you know, plumbers, etc. So it's sought after skills, and industry is willing to pay more than what we can pay. So that's one element. The second thing is that where we're using construction companies, we currently have a gap that we don't have enough construction companies that have to do our maintenance. To give you an example, we went out in tender about 12 months ago to appoint a panel of construction companies in order to assist us with our maintenance. In that process, we were only able to appoint one construction company because most of them, they couldn't meet the SCM criteria that was set. That's one point. So we eventually have to appoint one service provider, which has now started to deal with backlog maintenance, which you can see translating into the numbers. But not only that, even to get to a point where you appoint a service provider, it takes long, and there it's a combination of many things. One, because of the tender process, I mean, it takes an average of about 3 to 4 months just to complete the tender process. But even if it takes that long with all the capacity as you have, we don't have enough SCM personnel to administer the process. Let me give an example of a Kruger. Kruger, we've got so many transactions which are dealt with by SCM officials. We need dedicated SCM officials to deal with tender processes because that process takes long, from bid specification, evaluation, all the way to adjudication. Currently, I had appointed an SCM manager who only worked for us for 1 month, and he was poached by an external service provider. Currently, you have finance managers who are overseeing SCM processes. And again, because they're doing their finance as a day job and SCM as a night job, things delays. And that's the challenge that we're currently facing. We are currently trying to even get other state entities to help us to tap into their panel in order to deal with our maintenance challenges that we currently have. And that's the challenge that we're actually experiencing both on the SCM side as well as dealing with the issues of capacity in terms of people who are helping us. And that's why you see so much gap of 72 million where we are behind in terms of our maintenance. But I will allow Glenn to add more on the issues of maintenance.
So you are saying you've got challenges in SCM?
Yes, Chair.
You don't have the people?
I don't have the people.
Why can't you appoint them? There's money here that you say is human resources cost. That there's money under expenditure. Why can't you appoint the people and the manager goes, advertise, get another one? It's in the nature of the workplace. People move from one workplace to another.
Correct, Chair. We are currently, for example, I've just signed an appointment for a new manager at end of February, who's serving notice in order to join us. And that's happening with all other SCM practitioners around. But we still have a gap because currently people are not there to do the job. We have approached GTEC and the National Treasury to actually assist us to place people within SANPARK, and we are willing to pay National Treasury as long as those people can capacitate our SCM function so that we are able to do our job. And currently that process as well, it's hitting a snail pace because National Treasury Office of the Chief Procurement Office have not signed a deviation to appoint GTEC. So we are trying many different approaches. It's a government technical advisory center, which is a government component within the National Treasury. It helps government to make sure that they are resourced and they are capacitated in order to be able to perform certain functions where they lack capacity.
Mr.
Okay.
Glenn?
Thank you, Chair. Chair, from a Kruger perspective, over the last 10 years or so, there's been a concerted effort in terms of small contractor development, which has worked well. But what's happened over the last period of time, our salary scales are not growing at what the demand is for those scarce skills in terms of project management, technical skills in terms of plumbing, air conditioning or refrigeration, and roads particularly, which require certain skills. We are hiring people, particularly in terms of transformation, ladies that have qualified, have got the skills, and we have them for a few months and they post a higher salary. It just repeats itself time and time again. But it's those people that need to manage the small contractor development process because it's project management is key. And because that was failing, we ended up having to do one project two or three times where we're spending three times the amount of money because the contractor gets his advantage to start the project, gets the money that's required to get going, fails, another one comes in, has to pick up the pieces, more money. It's become a major issue. So what the CFO is talking about, we then decided let's go for a higher level CIDB, 7 or 8 contractor instead of the smaller contractors, who we build into that contract, supplier development and project management into that contract. It was that process that took over a year to get one contractor through there because it's quite onerous in terms of what we're expecting them to deliver in terms of skills transfer and supplier development in the areas. So that's where the challenge has been specifically. We also have very technical aspects, which is a big challenge for us right now. The air wing requires very specialist understanding of the aircraft and in terms of what's required in terms of procurement. And there's certain deviations we have to continue getting because you have to work with a certain supplier like Airbus for an Airbus helicopter you can't get from anywhere. And that requires certain processes every time, which we're getting a lot of support on to do, but it delays processes, and we can't afford to make mistakes around those areas. So it's a myriad of issues that are affecting supply chain. I must just highlight that about 2 weeks ago, EXCO met with all the supply chain officials to find out where the challenges lie, and we now understand clearly what the key challenges are, which we are attempting to address. And it also comes down to operational issues. I must defend the CFOs, not only supply chain management, if the specifications aren't clear, you're not going to get the right aspects procured. And that becomes, again, down to the skills at operational level to clearly define what's required. And if those skills aren't there, the specifications aren't clear. So it's a myriad of challenges we're sitting around supply chain, and that then has a effect on the actual delivery in terms of maintenance. If I can then, Chair, just touch on the other issue, which is around Skakuza Lodge.
Do you have a person dedicated for infrastructure in Sandparks. Because it looks like you are doing a lot of infrastructure work. So you need to have a capacity for infrastructure, both for construction, new project, and maintenance of those. CEO, do you have that? Do you have a unit that deals with the infrastructure?
Chair, we do, in terms of planning, prioritizing. But in terms of SCM, it's done through his office. Therefore, there's a challenge in terms of no separate dedicated capacity for infrastructure. It's all centralized. But in terms of project planning, monitoring, professional services, there's a unit doing that.
Chair, could I add to that?
Okay.
Chair, so in the new structure, which is going through the organizational design process, we've identified a need for a managing executive infrastructure development, so that they can be far more focused. Because at the moment, each park has its technical teams. And then we've got in Kruger, we've got a engineer in charge of technical services, and in parks, we have a department that deals with technical issues. But it needs more focus, and I think that's what you're touching on. That is being recommended in terms of the new organizational design.
Okay. Can we step off? Or, hold on, Kun?
In the new lodge.
Okay. And then Honourable will come.
Chair, Honourable Purden, yes, the latest green technology is implemented in the lodge. So all grey water systems that are implemented, and those will all be measured and monitored through a building management system so we can see the impact going forward.
Okay, Honourable Purden.
Thank you, Chair. Just one question, Chair, on the total number of visitors. I'm not sure. It's not very specific. I know that it will be categorized according to your local and international. If we just have a blanket understanding that there is a decrease, it would be best to understand which one was most hit. Is it the local? Is it the international? Is it the schools? That one will give us an idea as to which category is most hit by this decrease. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. Honourable Pader?
The question about II and Richtersveld wasn't answered.
Chair, this project was actually already signed off at the end of 2014. But because of logistical problems between II and the Richtersveld side, which is our side, they couldn't agree in terms of an MOU to be signed between them in terms of which percentage goes to which of the two different countries, let's call it that, or the two different entities. And also, as the years continued, costs increased in terms of this project. So, during this year, the DG had actually indicated that we have to stop that project.
Okay.
Just one last from Oral Mkuno on categorizing. Above 70% of our tourists are locals. But what we've picked up in this trend, locals are more affected in terms of traveling to parks. But in next time, we'll split it in our slide to show it.
Okay, can we move to... All right, thank you very much, Sandparks. We'll see you again when we confirm with the minister. Hopefully, we'll be ready to give us more detail on the proposed agreement. But otherwise, 72%. You are getting in there. Remember, you are left with only this month to do whatever that you have to do, because the end of this month, you must then start compiling your information for the 2018-19
annual report.
Annual report.
Yes, Chief.
All right. Thank you very much. CEO?
I wish, I know the time is a challenge. I wish this committee can visit the western boundary just to interact with some stakeholders before you recess. I wish. I know the time is a problem.
Yeah, I doubt if it's going to happen.
Okay.
Maybe the next committee will do that. I doubt if Honorable Frolic will allow us to do an oversight. You can give us the picture so that you can have an idea about what's happening there. But yeah, we'll have one last more before we finish with the minister. But otherwise, thank you very much, Shoni. We have given us a briefing on update on the CITES preparation, but we thought now that the date is approaching, it's going to be in March, not March, is it April or so?
In May.
May,
yes, May 23rd.
Now that it's approaching, let's get the update, including, I'm sure you have already finalized the proposals, taken them through cabinet. If you have done so, please just give us an update. Remember, we had an issue about the rhinos in particular. We're interested to find out what will be the proposal from South Africa on rhinos and on the rhinos in particular. Yeah, okay. Over to you. We don't have much time, so please just try and congest.
We'll try to. I won't follow the presentation, and I will take, if there's any question specific to any slide, we'll provide that, Chair. But suffice to say that, Chair, we've been hard at work. The conference is coming on the 23rd of May to the 3rd of June in Sri Lanka. For this period, Chair, we are preoccupied with this. If I may explain, Chair, that with CITES, countries that have to make proposals, make their proposals prior to the 150 days before the commencement of the COP. In this case, the 24th of December was a cut-off date for putting through countries' proposals. After the 24th, we then had to look at how many proposals are there, because some of the proposals will cite us, only have direct implications to us, and we need to prepare ourselves in terms of the response. As we speak now, we're sitting with close to 162 documents, some of those being proposals, some of them being draft resolutions that we have to go through. We have done that since the 24th of December. January, we've been working on that. February, we've been working on that. We needed to go back and make sure that we again consult stakeholders, even those that have sent, because what we did from the beginning was that we called for proposals, open call on newspapers, anyone with any proposal that you would want us to look at. We got those, subjected them to a scientific authority process. That scientific authority process works against, they subject those proposals against the CITES criteria. If it's a proposal for uplisting or downlisting or whichever kind of listing, because there are different listings in CITES, one and two being most prominent, one being that you won't trade with this species, two being that you can trade, there could be certain annotations or conditions, or there may not be conditions, and three more relaxed in that regard. So once we received those, they were analyzed based on that. The report was provided by the scientific authority. They sent that back to us with some recommendations. What we then looked at was, how do we take them forward? If I may come to the specific question that Chair
and the portfolio committee asked then as to what's our posture on some of this. I will come to that one in particular that you're referring to. We advanced three proposals from South Africa. The first one being that I hope I'm pressing the button properly. Yes, there we are. The first one was to amend the listing of Aluferro, which is currently listed in Appendix 2, meaning that you can trade, but there are conditions. Conditions are referred to in scientist language as annotation, that there are certain conditions that prevent us, even a finished product, to just go out of the country. So a finished product, whether it's in liquid form, already packaged, ready for use, for it to be traded outside the country and exported, you need to follow a stringent CITES process. And with the abundance of Aluferro in South Africa, and also the fact that we are not, or the species is not subjected to containing forms of trade that affect its survival in the wild, we have put through a proposal to remove those so that we can exclude finished products from regulations under CITES. Of course, local processes will still apply, trade-related.
So Aluferro is just the alu that we know.
Yes, there's a specific
one. The one the minister brought when he...
The one the minister, yes, brought, and we thought of bringing some products here, and we will hope to share some products with the minister. But the one that the minister brought in
minister
the budget...
Minister of Finance,
Minister of Finance, yes, that's the one. So in the Eastern Cape, Western Cape, it's in abundance, and there's a lot of trade in that, but there are certain hindrances on the basis of CITES processes. So we need to deal with that. So the second issue that we put through was that we do have black rhino. Of course, the numbers are not as many as compared to the white rhino, of course, around 2,000 less than that. On CITES currently, we have a maximum of 5 in terms of quota of offtake from trophy hunting perspective. And we are requesting that we have the quota framed in percentage form, because depending on the trends analysis, 5 may be too high, 5 may be too low, but if we work on a percentage form to say not exceeding 0.5 with the current population, you're talking about 8 or 9 or so maximum. That may not be exceeded. So that's how we're trying to frame. The third one has got to do with African grey. We are not the range state in terms of the African grey parrots in South Africa. They've been here through captive breeding operations for years, to an extent that we now have what we call F2s. F2s would mean that your first generation, second generation, so they are no longer, people who are trading with this are not allowed to source from the wild anymore. So they're breeding in captive breeding facilities. We export, as South Africa being the highest exporter, close to around 80,000 birds or so. In the last COP, we were directed to register. We've got close to 1,600 or so captive breeding facilities in this regard. All of them need to be registered appropriately. The process is painstaking.
So they are being exported?
They are being exported, yes.
For what purpose?
They are exported for as pets. People would keep them as pets in there for personal use, some of them as pets, and others for a variety of purposes. You will get them, I think my colleague here will go into the details. I didn't introduce my colleague, so on my right it's the director for CITES and TOPS, Olga Kumalo. She deals with these matters of TOPS and movements daily. So
she's the new one.
She's been 4 years.
What is it?
I don't know how many years. I found her. I think it's 5 years, right, for now. But she's been with the Department of Environmental Affairs in this space for.
She's coming for the first time here. Is it for the first time?
No. She's not represented.
Okay.
Oh, she has presented before, yes.
Because we got a briefing last year on preparation for site. Yes. She wasn't there.
She was there. Yes, okay. Yes. So if she has to add in terms of the details, 140 of those captive breeding facilities have already been done. So because we were given a time frame to say register by this time, we're putting in a proposal to ask for an extension of the period. We have so many other proposals that have direct implications to us. I will only indicate few, but I will start with the one that you raised, Chair. We have not put a proposal that will put South Africa to trade in rhino horn. So there's no proposal on the table for that purpose. Our rhinos are still listed in Appendix 2 with the annotation that has been put through. We do have, however, countries that, if I may, I don't know whether I will be able to press it and take it there specifically, but there's a proposal by Eswatini. They are in the situation that we are in at the moment. They are putting up a proposal to remove that annotation. The annotation says that you have your populations in Appendix 2, but only allowing for offtakes that may be specifically for trophy hunting purposes and also live sales. And they want to remove that to just have their rhinos listed in Appendix 2 without any annotation or without any condition, which in effect would mean that they then can trade. That is the proposal that they are putting through. There's also a proposal by Namibia. Namibia is saying that they would want their population to be transferred from Appendix 1, meaning no trade at all, to be in Appendix 2, of course with the annotation that is similar to what South Africa has. So then they will be allowed to trade with live animals to appropriate and acceptable destinations. They will be allowed to have a hunting trophies or hunting in that regard. So there is that aspect. There are other proposals that have been put through by other countries. With the CITES, you are in a situation where countries, even if they don't have those species, they can put up a proposal that affects another country and even cite that country. And they may say that elephants or lions of South Africa, Zambia, Zimbabwe, Namibia, Botswana should be put in this particular category, so or appendix. So those are some of the proposals that are there. On African lion, there's a new resolution that Togo and Nigeria have put through, and they would want to put some stringent measures to prevent hunting of lions, for an example. You also have...
what is the proposal here?
Number 76 there. They are putting a new resolution that will put stringent measures that will prevent hunting of lions, for an example.
What lions?
All African lions. Lions in the wild. Or lions. Let's just say
in the
lions.
Wild.
Let me just say that will prevent lions to be hunted. African lions to be hunted in the main. So that in itself, when you look at the proposal, it will, because the biggest threats affecting lions in the main is habitat loss and also human-wildlife conflict, especially in areas where you find the declining numbers. There are specific threats that even IUCN and others have also looked at and quantified. So some of these proposals don't deal with the core issues of the problem. And in that case, whether you list higher or list lower or you change the listing, and if you are not addressing the core, the challenge itself, you find yourself not going anywhere, and that creates a problem. There's also another interesting proposal that we looked at as something that affects us. This one has been put through... In the slides that Chairperson, we have some years back, South Africa, Zimbabwe, Namibia, I think Botswana as well, we're allowed to have a once-off sale of ivory.
to a specific destination countries that came forth. I think Japan was one of them at that time. And that once of sale, I think it was 2007 or 2008 at the time. So there was an annotation that was written in this form. So that's why we put the text and we strike through. This is what was written there. Part of what was written was that South Africa and all these countries should not come back to CITES to say we want another ones of sale. At the time, we got the money that we are using for elephant research and elephant protection support. That's the money that's administered through SANParks, and it supports that. And they said, you will not come back to COP, to CITES or to CITES COP before 9 years. And 9 years expired in 2016. Most of these things are absolute. So we were saying, but these things are absolute, and they may not be relevant anymore. Then there's another proposal that was put through by Burkina Faso, Cote d'Ivoire, Kenya, Liberia, Nigeria, Sudan, and Syria, and Togo to transfer populations of Botswana, Namibia, South Africa, and Zimbabwe from Appendix 2 to Appendix 1. Because currently, our elephants are listed in Appendix 2 with the annotations as well, of course, the conditions that are indicated there, but now to put them in Appendix 1, even with live ones, no movement, no reintroductions to other countries, so it's all these stringent measures, which has its own challenges for these countries. Zambia would want to transfer their population from Appendix 1 to Appendix 2, but they put some conditions themselves, being allowed to trade in registered raw ivory, and then they put the arguments on that. So there are a number of proposals that we have put through in those tables that I may not necessarily go through, but this one which I think we need to highlight here, we have co-sponsored a text that, or a proposal that will look at the review of the convention itself. What we are saying is that this thing is not moving. CITES is 44 years now coming to this COP, and a lot has been changing over time, some of it also moving from the core mandate of what CITES was all about. Because CITES is very, very clear, even in the convention text, that is there to ensure that international trade in endangered species of fauna and flora does not compromise the survival of species in the wild. So a lot is happening now where some of the decisions are taken without, or are proposed, or some of the proposals that are put through, some of them do not necessarily meet the requirements, even if it's a proposal for uplisting or downlisting in some cases. So science has to inform what CITES has to do. Some of the decisions are informed from an emotional, ethical basis, and in danger as a result if they are taken. Some of those species and things that we would want to achieve, we end up not achieving. There are issues around demand reduction as well. It's quite a big issue. I think, Chair, you have requested us to relook at this particular matter as well and come to the committee and still talk to it. And this demand reduction has its own challenges in the sense that the reduction by some means reduction of both legal and illegally acquired species. That creates a challenge on its own, because there should be a distinction between what is legally acquired and legal trade and illegal trade. And those two things should not be confused. And that also creates a problem. The rules of procedures would also have to be looked at. I may not go through the details of that, but to...
Can we just go through this agenda items quickly?
Okay.
Which affects South Africa, yeah?
Okay. Agenda item 4, rules of procedure, EU... for years and in different COPs would come in and want to adjust the rules of procedure to be allowed to have one vote that represents all their countries, irrespective of whether they are in the room or not. And that is what its own implications, in the sense that you have countries that may not be there physically,
and that creates a problem because you cannot vote if you are not there, and you cannot vote as a bloc even if they are a regional integration organization. It may create some problems. So we have raised issues and concerns even in the previous one. Demand reduction is the one that I was talking through to combat illegal trade. So parties are requested to invest a lot in terms of demand reduction. We do have a view on this one. As much as we support the issues of demand reduction insofar as it relates to illegal trade, we have to make sure that where illegal trade does not endanger or the species in the wild or the survival of the species in the wild and is done in a well-regulated form can still continue. That's where the essence of who CITES is in the process also comes in. Rural communities, we sponsored that, we need to have a system that also allows those that are affected to have a voice. Whether feedback from what comes from CITES or in the process of formulating certain decisions that will affect them. So that when we deal with these things, at the end of the day, parties have to implement. And when they implement domestically, and there are people that are unduly affected, but they never had a voice in the process. So there are parties who don't want this program of finding a way and modalities for rural communities to also have an input in the process to continue, and this thing to just be put aside and not be pursued. Youth engagement is part of late Minister Smilawa's legacy. We had launched this in COP16. We still want to continue and make sure that the youth voice is taken care of in the process. In South Africa, we do have the youth desk as part of the People and Parks program. Domestic markets for frequently illegally traded species. So this one is meant to address domestic illegal trade, because you do have things that happen illegally, but there is also a principle that we keep on upholding in South Africa, that CITES need not go beyond its mandate of dealing with international trade and start prescribing to parties. It doesn't mean that CITES must not provide guidance on certain aspects that may have international implications. So sovereign rights as a principle would have to be looked at while the support is also provided. Due diligence by parties. Here, there's a big issue that's coming through to say, irrespective of whether it's a legal trade and there's a receiving country on the other side, what the receiving country must still verify whether verify the traceability, must still make sure that the documentation is proper. If they are not satisfied that even the NDF that has been presented is adequate, they can still ask for further documentation. So giving a payment and issuing a payment with this would then mean that it's still not yet done. You still are at the mercy of the country that is receiving to also make sure that they also check, because the receiving country, the exporting country, must both be, which is what is being proposed here, must both be not liable but must be responsible in the deal. There are specimens that are confiscated, or those that would, like what happened not long ago in Hong Kong. And some are live specimens, whether it's reptiles, it's snakes, it's chameleons, it's this, it's that. Some would go from one country to the other illegally. When they are taken, they need to be managed, they need to be placed somewhere, they need to be looked after. Some of them may need to be disposed. If they are to be disposed, so there's guidelines that are put through to deal with that. If they are disposed or euthanized, if it comes to that, which is not a desirable thing to do, but anyway, if it comes to that, it has to be done humanely, and there are certain guidelines that have to be put. If it has to be put in custody, who is responsible for that? It goes in with that. Appropriate and acceptable destination. This one is a very big issue, because most of the live specimens that leave countries, CITES rules will say that, especially when it comes to rhino, they must go to appropriate and acceptable destination. What is an appropriate and acceptable destination? There's a list of things that this document and the guidance provides in terms of that. There should be this, there should be that, there should be the duty of care in terms of veterinarians, the social well-being, the size of the area, the space, all those things are defined as something that must be looked at. So we'll also be looking at that decision. In terms of the captive bred and ranched specimen, Chair, I need to indicate here that most of the animals that are being traded are, in the past, most of when CITES started then in 44 years ago. Trading in those species were coming from species that were sourced from the wild. The number of sourcing from the wild is going down, while most of the species are now coming from captive bred facilities. So the dynamics are changing in that regard. So this is being looked at as well. So captive bred and raised specimen, and also looking at what are the processes to monitor that. How do we deal with the captive bred specimen? I did speak about the review of the convention, but insofar as what we would want to put through in the proposal that is being put through, go to the next slide, there was this number 60. So 60, 69 on illegal trade in cheetahs, of course, is to address the illegal trade in cheetahs, but on the elephants, there is a monitoring group that deals with monitoring and reporting of activities impacting on elephants. So all trade issues related to elephants, including monitoring and reporting, would have to be dealt with. We have our pangolins listed in Appendix 1. There is still lots of movements that are concerning on the use of pangolin scales in different countries. So this one is to address trade issues. So we'll forever have this issue as long as this concern. I did speak about the African lion and the other ones that are there. There is also, if we come to the giraffe, a proposal by Mali, Kenya, Niger, Senegal, Chad, Central African Republic to have the giraffe also listed in Appendix 2. Giraffe at the moment is not a CITES listed species. It's also another issue. It's not a CITES listed species.
Giraffe?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So then they are putting up a proposal. So we have looked at all of these 162 either proposals, draft resolutions, draft decisions, and in each one of them, we have indicated what we think South Africa's position should be, and we have qualified why. We have also, on the proposals, gone into the science of the details of the trends involving that species that is affected. The scientific authority finalized their report and presented to us, I think it was on the 28th of February. So we have that. We have initiated, Chair, a process with all of this analysis of the cabinet process that will then give us the mandate on each and every one of those areas that we have said have direct and indirect implications to South Africa. And then we'll take it as such. We will still be meeting with other parties. We hosted the SADC Common Position workshop. We are still again hosting that. We hosted one before the 24th of December. We are going to host one again now in March 21st here in South Africa so that we finalize the common positions. We are participating also in the Africa initiatives on a number of issues. Some of them are thematic. We will be meeting with other parties, including the pending meeting that may happen even next week with the EU, on matters that affect them and matters that affect us, so that they would understand where we come from, would understand where their positions are, and there are other specific countries and specific regions that we are engaging on specific matters. We have established a task team comprised of provinces and other specialists that will be working with us in that task team, going through for the last time and pitching ourselves so that we could give and do justice to what is of the best interest of the country. Thank you, Chair.
Okay, thank you.
That was well done, quick, to the point, but with more details for us to be able to understand and engage. I see Honorable Pedersen's hands is up. Your hand was up. Do you want to? Yes, yeah.
There is quite a lot in a short time there, but I think unless I'm missing something, on the agenda items with direct implications for South Africa, there's no indication whether our delegation will propose or go, at least support or go against the Swaziland and Namibian proposals regarding the Rhino. The Swaziland proposal in this thing is very vague for me, so maybe someone can give us some detail on that. And then also vague is this increasing, this is our proposal, export quota for black Rhino from 5 adults to not exceeding 0.5. I mean, who decides? I mean, is it an accurate census? Why would you want to tamper with something? I don't know what the motivation is for that. You know, go from 5 to 8. I mean, I don't understand that. So if you know, so the rhino position and the scientific authority recommendation regarding those other countries.
Okay. Yeah. Any response?
My colleagues will come in. Thanks very much, Honorable Pedro. If I may start with the Namibian proposal. Just go to that slide there. The Namibian proposal calls for the transfer of population from Appendix 1 to Appendix 2. Currently, they are not in the position that we are as South Africa. South Africa has this annotation that allows for live animals and hunting trophies in that regard. It is not taking it into them trading in rhino horn at all. It's in the main looking at the live animals and hunting trophies, which is the current situation that South Africa is. It is different from the Swaziland one. The Eswatini proposal is talking about the removal of the annotation, meaning that it's just Appendix 2 listing, right, without any annotation. The question that the Honorable is asking is what are the motivations. They provide a document that indicates why and what are the trends, what is the population status, the trends over time, the population growth in numbers, and they put all of those on the table. Their scientific authority, even our scientific authority, looks at some of these things, and the scientific authority would only provide a scientific analysis that would say this meets the requirements or it doesn't meet the requirement in the main. A decision from South Africa looks at a number of other issues, including enforceability, traceability of things, including the stockpiles that is available, including the trends that have been for years, including many, many other aspects. I did not pronounce, and I'm not sure, we are not pronouncing at the moment as to how this is going to be attended to from a position perspective. We did look at it, and have in the process, Honorable Pardon, that we are putting through to Cabinet, to this becomes also an issue for how we can go about it. Scientifically, they may be meeting all the requirements, and then would have to look at it in the context of how South Africa would want to respond to this. So the Namibia one is quite different, but the Eswatini one, as you have indicated, it's what I've explained. The black rhino, Honorable Pardon, we have qualified it in our proposal. We have qualified it to say only those males that have gone past their reproductive stage could be subject to that offtake and that number. No male that is below or before its reproductive stage, no male that is above its, I mean, that is in its reproductive stage, no female should be subjected to this, and it's only linking and it's only pronouncing on the males that are post.
ecologically, of course, they may be playing a particular role, but they are not contributing to any population growth whatsoever. And as such, that should be the stringent process that must be followed in that regard to avoid any interference with the population of the black rhinos, because we don't want to interfere with the population of the black rhino. And many other stringent conditions that follow that, on how the hunt should be done or can be done, and all those things which we already have with the current quota that we have at the moment. The owners of private owners in particular, in the national parks, of course, that hunting will not happen. In the private facilities, there's a very serious pressure at the moment in terms of keeping and managing this and having resources to, because they don't rely necessarily on tourism per se. There are others who are doing well in terms of having the numbers, and even the black rhinos, who would have one or two as part of their offtakes to support the protection efforts, which are becoming more and more expensive as we speak. And some of them are becoming so distressed to may not be able to do it. So we think that there is no impact on the population whatsoever in the formulation that we have put through, because we had the same concern that Honorable Member raised.
Okay. All right, so basically the Eswatini proposal, it's almost similar to what some of the organizations in South Africa were calling for. Okay. All right, I think we have concluded the discussion. It's a briefing. We understand what the issues are then going to CITES. And we'd like to thank you very much, Shoni, for the briefing together with your team. I would have loved you to allow one or both of them to say something, you know. except just to speak to us through body language. It's expensive to come to Cape Town, so when you are here, you must at least say something. Something. but otherwise, no. For the next meeting. Yeah, thank you very much. Honorable members, thank you. Only Honorable Peden was the most active today. The ladies are resting today, preparing for next week. Honorable Steenkamp, you have been very quiet today, it's unlike you. Okay, thank you very much, the meeting is adjourned.
Ross speaking, hello.